He told voters he would break up a system that favored the privileged over the masses. What he lacked in breadth and depth, he made up for with a bright, tight thunderbolt of a message that benefited from the echo effect of Trump's populism in the Republican primary. His platform of breaking up big banks, providing universal single-payer health care, and subsidizing free college tuition for students suffocated her among the white economic liberals who dominate the Democratic electorates in Iowa, New Hampshire, and many other states. But this was not the only set of voters she found in the primaries, and the calendar after New Hampshire would allow Hillary another chance to fashion a message that would get her campaign on track. A few days before the election, Hillary tapped Sullivan and Schwerin to turn her message toward the voters of color she would need to win in upcoming contests. Unlike her 2008 campaign, Hillary's 2016 sequel was obsessed with the critical goal of winning as many delegates to the Democratic convention as possible. By the time in 2008 that she realized Obama had a better strategy for racking up delegates by dominating her in low turnout caucus states and among African American voters, it was way too late for her to reverse the cold mathematical reality of her defeat. In that year, African Americans had voted as a block in Southern primaries, delivering massive delegate hauls to Obama. Based on polling, reports from allies in various states, and Hillary's long-standing relationships in the black community, she and her team believed she had a substantial advantage with African American voters in 2016. But through Iowa and New Hampshire, two of the whitest states in America, it was an untested question. To kindle her own southern firewall in South Carolina on February 27th, and in several Super Tuesday states on March 1st, Hillary had to press her edge with black voters. At a meta level, that meant breaking out of the box Sanders had trapped her in by talking only about economic issues and taking positions so liberal that they would be unsustainable in a general election. He could out-socialist her every day of the week and twice on election Tuesdays, and he did. If she had said she thought bankers should be taxed at 90%, he would have said 95%. These economic issues, Sanders believed, would endear him to voters of color. After all, African American and Hispanic workers would benefit from minimum wage increases, a Medicare for all healthcare system, and more redistributive tax policies, and on many of his programs, disproportionately so. But Hillary thought there was more at stake than just pure economics for these voters. Internal campaign data culled just before the New Hampshire primary showed that Hillary's criminal justice message played well with African American voters. The groundwork for appealing to the African American community was already there. In the early days of the campaign, she had given a speech calling for the end of the era of mass incarceration, piggybacking on bipartisan criminal justice reform efforts in the Senate and rejecting the results of major portions of the 1994 crime law her husband had supported and signed. The best scoring attack lines against Bernie with both races were on his scrapping Obamacare for a single-payer national health care system, and his votes on gun issues. Sanders's singular focus on economic equality gave Hillary the opening to portray him as inattentive to other issues of importance to African American voters. For some time, African American elected officials, friends, and advisors had been telling Hillary how she and Sanders were perceived in the black community. The key difference, which could turn out to be a strength or a liability, was that black voters knew Clinton and didn't know Sanders. That gave him an opportunity to define himself and gain ground on her. But if she could get there first, while he was celebrating his victory in New Hampshire and in the debate a couple of days later, she would have the chance to define him in negative terms. So while Sullivan and Schwerin hold up to draft her speech on Newcastle, an exclusive island off the coast of New Hampshire, Hillary flew to Flint, Michigan, a majority black city where a water poisoning crisis had left residents feeling that their government had failed them. Leaving New Hampshire 2 days before the primary might have raised eyebrows, but knowing how badly she was going to lose and how much she needed to differentiate herself with black voters, no one on her team raised an objection. In any case, by the next day, it would be hard for her aides to focus fully on the world outside her campaign or even beyond their own jobs. On the afternoon before primary day, several of Hillary's senior staffers were working in an unfinished conference room attached to the Radisson Hotel in Manchester when a bruising Politico story surfaced. It foretold a campaign staff shakeup. Benenson and digital director Teddy Goff were called out as weak links. The aides sat in mortified silence as they thumbed the faces of their phones and the scroll bars of their laptops, looking for their own names and those of both friends and rivals. The truth was, Clinton's senior staff, including Podesta, Mook, Benenson, Palmieri, Sullivan, Schwerin, Shockey, and Grunwald, had hardly said a word to one another all week in the drab and dour conference room, preferring to quietly bide their time until Tuesday's political execution by the New Hampshire electorate. But now the silence turned oppressive. "We didn't really know," said one source who was in the room. Goff was stunned. He thought he had a good relationship with Hillary and that her inability to catch fire online, his mission, had more to do with the social stigma of being with her and against Bernie than it did with any failure of strategy or tactics. She just couldn't go viral for anything positive. But no one was surprised by the idea that Benenson was on the hot seat. Mook, who knew he was on shaky ground despite the public acclaim he'd gotten for pulling out Iowa and having dodged the brunt of the Politico story, advised his colleagues to focus on their work, not the media surrounding it. "Put your head down," he told them. In the hours that followed, some aides received personal reassurances about their standing. Aberdeen pulled Goff aside and told him that Clinton had emailed to say, "She loves you." But it was a moment of crisis for most of the team, and no one wanted to be in New Hampshire any longer than they had to. Mook heeded his own advice. Not 2 hours later, he instructed his team to prepare for a major strategy shift after the loss, one that aligned with the turn Hillary took in going to Flint. "It would be important," he said, "to sell the idea that Bernie was the favorite in Nevada on the 20th, and Hillary would be dominant in South Carolina on the 27th. In theory, that would help temper the barrage of coming stories about Bernie's resurgence. Second," he said, "the new message had to root her candidacy in a moral mission and shore up trust issues. And third, he announced a major change in the campaign's tack against Bernie. We are realigning our surrogate team to hit Bernie much harder, with a disciplined focus on, one, his plans don't add up and he won't deliver, and two, he is not ready to be commander-in-chief. Surrogates would be trained to go after Sanders much more aggressively in on-the-record remarks to the media, one that reflected Hillary's desire to get tougher with him." By this point, Sullivan and Schwerin had been working on Hillary's New Hampshire concession remarks for several days. The basic idea was a Trojan horse. On the outside, her speech would appear to be a basic acknowledgement of her loss. But it would carry a new message designed to show that she was the candidate for voters of color and women, and that Bernie was not. The two men fashioned a tagline, "Breaking Barriers," and presented the speech to Hillary on the morning of the February 9th primary. "You guys missed the point," a frustrated Hillary thought. This doesn't draw a real contrast with Bernie. It wasn't enough for her to vow to deliver for voters when he was promising more. She had to show that his plans were pie in the sky and that she could bring results that would improve their daily lives. She wanted to go at Bernie much harder, to drive the point home with no ambiguity. Earlier that week, during a debate, she'd accused him of executing an artful smear by suggesting, but not outright saying, that she was corrupt. He was an inferior candidate, she thought, and he was mopping up the floor with her in New Hampshire. It was time to hit back. She told Sullivan and Schwerin their branding was too aspirational and that it didn't work as a contrast against Bernie. She was also upset that they had written her a full speech, the kind she might give on the heels of a victory, rather than quick remarks that could let her slip away from a bad performance quickly. "We weren't expecting a long, formal speech tonight, and then discovered there was one," Abedin told Podesta. And she wasn't happy. Hillary beckoned Schwerin and Sullivan to iron it out. She ultimately accepted the Breaking Barriers slogan, reluctantly, and they shaved her speech down to about 10 minutes. Hillary was at her wit's end when it came to her messaging, dismayed by the campaign's lack of inspiration. Here she was, a year into her campaign and about to get trampled by a socialist, and Breaking Barriers was the best her staff could come up with. She wasn't panicked, but she was coming to grips with the idea that, even with years to think about it, the campaign team she'd built was no better than its 2008 predecessor at helping her find an articulable vision for the country. In late January, as Hillary's campaign began to think about evolving the core message, Ron Klain chimed in with a succinct analysis of what was missing. "We need to invest more time in describing what HRC wants to do for America if she becomes president," he wrote to her top campaign brass. "What is it that she wants to do as president? How would America be different? What should people be excited about? What we need to deliver is a more compelling message on America under HRC." Schwerin replied with a telling insight into Hillary that everyone in her orbit understood but couldn't or wouldn't impress upon her. "I think Ron's right, but the irony here is that HRC talks about hardly anything else," the frustrated speechwriter asserted. "Her stump has always been a long recitation of what she wants to do as president. We've rolled out a million detailed policies. Our problem is missing the forest for the trees. We've never found a good way, or at least a way she embraces, that sums up her vision for how America would be different." It was a vision Hillary herself couldn't articulate for them. But the one aspect of her campaign that she was most confident about was that none of the tribes, separately or in collaboration, had any idea how to construct a winning message for her. In her view, it was up to the people she paid to find the right message for her, a construction deeply at odds with the way Sanders and Trump built their campaigns around their own gut feelings about where to lead the country. As they would on other election nights, the Clintons retreated to a warren of rooms at their hotel to await the results. In New Hampshire, it was the Radisson, a sprawling facility that could accommodate 2,500 people. Outside, there was snow on the ground, and the roads were icy throughout New England. Any comfort Hillary Clinton could find that night would be cold. The drubbing was so bad that the networks didn't wait 10 minutes, or even 5, to call it. They declared Bernie Sanders the winner within a minute or so of the polls closing. At the end of an ugly week, with some of their jobs reportedly on the line, that struck Hillary's brain trust as funny. Her aides chuckled like condemned prisoners awaiting the gallows. As her top aides shuffled onto an elevator to head to the victory rally, Hillary made sure to join them for the quick ride down. She was determined that they not lose their sense of purpose, and she wanted them to know she appreciated that they had worked hard even in defeat. It was an especially important moment because she knew they had all read the story about a staff shakeup. She'd been asked about it on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC the night before, and, while brushing off the specifics, essentially acknowledged that she was constantly assessing the state of her campaign. In the face of all of that, Hillary sensed a need to be gracious and to let her aides know she and they would be back to fight another day. "Thank you," she said softly. When Hillary found Vlasic backstage before she delivered her concession speech, he was heartbroken. For all his experience running statewide campaigns in New Hampshire, he hadn't been able to crack the code for Hillary. "I'm really sorry about this," he said, "but we're going to get them in November." "I can't think of what more we could have done," she said, hugging the bear of a man as he struggled to hold back tears. "You did a great job." Bill shook his hand. Hillary went out to give her speech before the final votes from Sanders' heart-stopping 22-point win had been reported. She struck upbeat notes as she began to pivot toward a new emphasis on social injustice that she hoped would help her lock down the votes of Black and Hispanic Democrats. Sanders gave her an opening to do so because of his singular attention to income inequality. Hillary knew, by contrast, that many Democratic voters believed that racism, for example, couldn't be solved simply by closing income gaps. When people anywhere in America are held back by injustice, that demands action. That is why I believe so strongly that we have to keep up with every fiber of our being the argument for, the campaign for human rights. Human rights as women's rights. Human rights as gay rights. Human rights as worker rights. Human rights as voting rights. Human rights across the board for every single American. Now that is who I am. That is what I've always done, she said to applause. At one of the bleakest moments of the campaign, with Bernie rising and Clinton's high command worried about getting fired, Bill and Hillary offered a small gesture of consolation to their team as they departed New Hampshire. Hillary ordered up a larger plane for the flight to New York and offered a ride home to the Brooklyn staff who had come to the Granite State at her insistence. As they boarded, the Clintons hugged their aides and tried to buck them up for the long road that would follow the short flight. On the hop from Manchester to New York, she and Bill settled into adjoining seats at the front of the jet. They fell asleep, her head on his shoulder, and his head propped against hers. Hillary had hidden her emotions as the drubbing unfolded, but she was demoralized and angry. She thought she'd built a campaign capable of zooming through the primaries. Even after everything she'd done to correct for her 2008 campaign, she now faced another brutal slog. She'd defied her own instincts by not taking shots at Bernie. Now he was the comeback kid, and she looked beatable. She was going to have to fight, both internally and state by state, for this nomination. "Now it's going to go to July, and it's going to be bloody," she confided to an aide in an unguarded moment before she left the state. "We should have figured out a way to deal with Bernie earlier." Chapter 9. Base Politics. "Secretary Clinton, you're not in the White House yet." It was February 11th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the site of the sixth Democratic presidential debate, one that came at a critical moment for both candidates. With his victory in New Hampshire, Sanders actually held a lead in pledged delegates. He was bringing in money faster than he could count it, and the question was whether he could build a wave strong enough to sweep over Clinton. This meeting with Sanders, who was getting much more adroit in debates and who now had the wind at his back, held tremendous risk for Hillary, and she was getting hammered. When Hillary talked about what she'd do as president, Sanders snapped back with the line about her measuring the Oval Office drapes. When she defended her original formulation that Latin American refugees should be turned away, Sanders suggested she lacked compassion. "Who are you sending a message to?" he asked rhetorically. "These are children who are leaving countries and neighborhoods where their lives are at stake." And when Hillary noted she talked foreign policy with Henry Kissinger, whom many liberals consider a war criminal, Sanders was ready with a sharp rejoinder. "I happen to believe that Henry Kissinger was one of the most destructive secretaries of state in the modern history of this country. I am proud to say that Henry Kissinger is not my friend. I will not take advice from Henry Kissinger." Internal and external polling still showed her leading among African American and Hispanic voters, communities that had enough voting power to bail her out. But her margin in Nevada, the next state to vote, was closing fast, and Sanders flooded the state with ground troops to try to pull off an upset. Hillary could put on a brave face for the cameras, and even with most of her aides, but the arduous schedule and the punishing rejection of New Hampshire voters were taking a psychic toll. It showed in the debate. Time and again, Sanders punched and counterpunched effectively. He might have been a little too aggressive at times, but Sanders was at his best in a big moment. He didn't seem ready, however, for what would turn out to be the biggest exchange of the night. In fact, no one but the Clinton camp was expecting it. Polling data and anecdotal evidence from allies strongly suggested that black voters would be turned off by Sanders's criticism of Obama over the years. We knew that particularly African Americans, but not only African Americans, found it distasteful that people would be attacking the president, and in particular Bernie's call for him to have a primary opponent in 2012, which didn't sit well, said one Hillary advisor who was involved in the prep for the Milwaukee debate. It was an act of disloyalty that few Democrats knew about, but it's one she would make damn sure every black voter had heard about by the time he or she went to the polls. It was the key to defining Sanders for black voters before the primary turned to the Deep South. Hillary had lined up to take this shot at Bernie a few days earlier in her New Hampshire concession speech. "Today, Senator Sanders said that President Obama failed the presidential leadership test," Hillary declared. "And this is not the first time that he has criticized President Obama. In the past, he has called him weak. He has called him a disappointment. He wrote a foreword for a book that basically argued voters should have buyer's remorse when it comes to President Obama's leadership and legacy. You know, from my perspective, maybe because I understand what President Obama inherited, not only the worst financial crisis, but the antipathy of the Republicans in Congress, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves for being a president who got us out of that." Hillary had been interrupted by applause. Sanders was taken aback at the new line of attack. He wasn't used to being called out as insufficiently supportive of Obama. In his liberal circles, it was de rigueur to criticize Obama for failing to take a harder line. But he didn't see himself as an opponent of the president or his agenda. He called the attack a low blow, noted that he had supported much of Obama's work from the Senate, and referred to himself as a friend of the president. He seemed satisfied with his response. Then Hillary moved in for the kill. Calling the president weak, calling him a disappointment, calling several times that he should have a primary opponent when he ran for re-election in 2012, You know, I think that goes further than saying we have our disagreements. Sanders landed a quick zinger. Well, one of us ran against Barack Obama. I was not that candidate. That won most of the attention from the press that night. But what he didn't appreciate was the extent to which African-American voters had not only forgiven Hillary for running against Obama, but had respected her for agreeing to go work for him. Hillary had done her homework. She and her husband were still held in high regard by most black voters, who had seen them work on issues of importance to communities of color for many years, and didn't like the outsider Sanders attacking the president or her. Hillary knew all of that intuitively. She knew it from the feedback she got from friends and political allies, and she knew in her bones that she was simply and clearly more at home in the black community than Sanders ever would be. In one exchange, she had successfully put daylight between Sanders and Obama and drawn herself even closer to the African-American community. She had placed Bernie outside a coalition that included her, Obama, and most black voters. It was a strikingly deft maneuver from a candidate often criticized for her lack of political skill. Pinning Bernie into a white base and refocusing her attention on minority voters would have important implications for both the nomination fight and the general election. While no community is monolithic, and Bernie was able to peel off some support from younger minority voters, Hillary's massive advantage among African Americans and Latinos was the key to her strategy for accumulating delegates to the Democratic Convention. The 4,765 Democratic delegates were split into two types, a set of 700-plus party leaders, called superdelegates, who could vote for whomever they chose, and more than 4,000 pledged delegates, who were bound to vote for a candidate based on the outcome in their home district or state. Each candidate would win a percentage of the statewide pledged delegates based on the percentage of the vote he or she won, and each would take a share of the pledged delegates available in each of the state's congressional districts based on his or her percentage of the vote there. Importantly, states with more population have a larger number of available delegates, and the delegates aren't spread evenly throughout a state's congressional districts. The total number of delegates available in a district is pegged to the district's performance for Democratic candidates in previous elections. It's all very complicated, but it boils down to this. A candidate who does best in the most Democratic parts of a state can rack up a lot of delegates fast. In many states, the delegate-rich districts are majority-minority. Hillary and her delegate-crunching team knew that running up the score among black and Hispanic voters would net her an outsized share of the delegates in populous states with more delegates available. Bernie had won New Hampshire by 22 points, but that netted him just a 15-9 delegate haul. Hillary could more than erase that with a good showing in a single black-majority district in Mississippi. From that Milwaukee debate through the end of the campaign, Hillary would never stray from the African-American base that provided her sustenance in key primary states and numbers in November battlegrounds. But there was a trade-off. Our failure to reach out to white voters, like literally from the New Hampshire primary on, it never changed, said one campaign official. No one in Clinton world was more in tune with Hillary's state of mind than Huma Abedin, the ever-present body woman, scheduler, and personal advisor. During the 2008 campaign, Hillary had surrounded herself with friends and aides who had been with her for nearly two decades. On this campaign, most of her advisors were professionals who had been brought in for their expertise rather than their understanding of the candidate. It was an issue that wouldn't ever go away. Hillary was being advised by people who thought they knew her. She'd been in the public eye for most or all of their adult lives. but really didn't have a feel for who she was at her core. While Hillary had long since grown weary of the high-paid consultants, even most of the campaign aides she liked and trusted weren't personally close to her. Many of them were a generation or more younger, and the cohort that had gained power internally was almost entirely male. Even before the devastating loss in New Hampshire, Aberdeen knew Hillary needed a little tender, loving care. So Aberdeen reached out to Minion Moore, a Chicago-born alum of Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns, who had worked in the Clinton White House, handled delicate political tasks for Hillary, and exchanged daily devotional quotations with her. "Minion," Huma said, "come quick." Moore abandoned her schedule in Washington to spend 5 or 6 days on the campaign trail crisscrossing the country. Minnesota, Nevada, Colorado, South Carolina, and New York in Hillary's small jet, and, like an amateur psychologist, listening to her friend. Moore was worried that no matter how much Hillary tried to tune out attacks from Sanders and from the half-dozen Republicans who remained in the race for the GOP nomination, some of it was getting to her. Her friend was anxious about the state of the campaign and about the mood of the electorate. On one of the flights, Hillary unburdened herself to Moore. "I don't understand what's happening with the country. I can't get my arms around it," Hillary confided. Moore just listened. "How do I get answers to this?" Hillary asked. It was a quandary that would plague her throughout the campaign. After nearly a year on the campaign trail and hundreds of stops at diners, coffee shops, and high school gymnasiums, and just as many round tables with young professionals and mill workers, Hillary still couldn't figure out why Americans were so angry or how she could bring the country together. She had tried to learn the lessons of 2008 and had built a campaign that was different, if too similar in some respects, this time around. But fundamental changes in the electorate eluded her grasp. She couldn't find ways to connect with portions of the primary electorate that were driven to Sanders because he represented an all-out assault on the establishment thinking at the core of her being. When she peeked at the Republican primary, she saw campaigns running into a similar problem. Jeb Bush, the favorite going into the race, was being pummeled by Trump. Like Sanders, the freewheeling billionaire businessman turned political force was taking advantage of the populist fury that had swept the nation. From her perspective, these guys weren't offering plausible solutions, but they were good at channeling anger. Meanwhile, she was running into the same trap as 2008. She was becoming the inevitable candidate of the status quo, the one she tried so desperately to avoid this time around by offering a raft of new policy proposals. Her message wasn't getting through, even in the moments that weren't dominated by the email scandal. The one thing Hillary could put her finger on was that her 2016 team wasn't doing any better of a job of figuring out how to connect her to the national sentiment. She was in a bubble, and so were the people around her. Together, they had a feel for national politics from the 2008 and 2012 campaigns, when the public was less dissatisfied with the Democratic establishment's inability to solve their problems. John Podesta and Neera Tanden, who were closer to the progressive movement because of their ties to the liberal think tank Center for American Progress, had warned that Sanders was positioned to tap into liberal angst. But Hillary didn't fully believe it until it happened, and she was backed up by sycophants and those on her campaign who weren't as attuned to the left. And though Bill's instinct to talk with voters outside of cities seemed right, he was, in many ways, practicing what some Clinton world denizens viewed as the politics of the past. Like Hillary, he still thought he could win the argument over whether the existing government could solve people's problems. Bill Clinton does not really get where the country is. He has this perception of politics which is very much like the 1990s, one of Hillary's advisors said in the midst of the primaries. The fact the government hasn't worked in a couple of years is really altering both parties. A frustrated, contemplative, and subdued Hillary Clinton landed in Las Vegas on February 13, 2016, 1 week before the state's caucuses. Bernie's legions flooded the state, and the news media fixated on the possibility that Sanders could send her reeling by knocking out a second straight victory. She couldn't help but be reminded of the intense battle she'd fought with Barack Obama in Nevada in 2008, the contest that had forged the reputations of Mook and Marshall. That had been a traditional fight between two campaigns using similar tried-and-true organizing tactics. But there was something very different about the paradigm in 2016. This time, Sanders continued to show he didn't have to slog through months of door-knocking, flesh-pressing, and phone-banking to build a force on the ground. The Bernie phenomenon was particularly scary to Hillary's team in Nevada for two reasons. Caucuses are traditionally low-turnout affairs, and Nevadans are particularly politically disengaged. Hillary's top aide in the state, Emmy Ruiz, had arrived in Nevada almost a year earlier, before the official launch of the campaign, at the direction of Marshall. With a small team and limited resources, Mook had already focused the lion's share of the campaign's money and attention on Iowa. The Texas-bred daughter of Mexican immigrants spent most of 2015 and early 2016 creating a field operation for Hillary. Ruiz and her lieutenants traveled across the state on a lower-key version of one of Hillary's hallmark listening tours, gathering information about the electorate and starting to spread the word about Hillary's priorities. Through the fall and winter, they formed relationships with a budding Hillary contingent in the state, including a group of so-called Dreamers, non-voting immigrants who were brought to the United States as children by their parents. They basically followed the playbook for a state-level campaign. But by the time Hillary arrived a week before the caucuses, it was clear to Ruiz that they were fighting an asymmetrical force in Sanders. His campaign could post something on Reddit or Facebook, and thousands of followers would show up for a rally in a state where politics was seldom at the forefront of anyone's mind. Hillary sat down with Ruiz in her hotel room atop the Art Deco-style Four Seasons in Las Vegas that Saturday. Huma was there, and so was Rory Reid, the son of Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. Downstairs, at the world-famous Mandalay Bay Casino, amid flashing lights and ringing bells, thrilled weekend wagerers downed cocktails, pumped coins into slot machines, and threw dice onto craps tables. Upstairs, inside the stale quiet of Hillary's room, a heaviness filled the air. Hillary felt like the entire world was against her. Sanders had landed a few blows at the debate in Milwaukee, and she couldn't buy a break in the press. She stared into the abyss of a second failed attempt to win the Democratic nomination. If she lost Nevada, she might rebound in the southern states that followed, but she might not. Either way, it would pierce the narrative that Sanders couldn't win in states with significant minority populations and increase the likelihood of a brutal battle for the nomination. To make matters worse, Hillary felt miserable physically. She wasn't just sick and tired of the attacks on her. She was literally tired and sick. A sinus infection gnawed on the insides of her skull. The moment itself became a test of her capacity to do what she told voters she would do for them, fight through barriers. She struggled with this one, battling illness and despondence. "What's the plan?" she asked, her voice loaded with fatigue. "What are we doing?" Though the questions were specific to Nevada, They also represented the larger existential issues Hillary wrestled with through the early months of 2016. This wasn't the Hillary who usually showed up for briefings. That Hillary peppered her aides with questions designed to elicit detailed information. This one was going through the motions. She was off. Like Abedin, who had called in Moore as a reinforcement for this campaign swing, and Moore herself, Ruiz saw before her a candidate who needed an emotional lift, an injection of optimism and energy. Ruiz, who had worked on the 2008 campaign but really came to appreciate Hillary when the former Secretary of State spoke at a mutual friend's low-profile funeral in 2014, took it upon herself to buck up her boss. Throughout the campaign, Hillary's aides felt the need to lift her spirits. Publicly, they portrayed her as undeterred by defeat. Podesta would later tell a reporter that, after New Hampshire, she didn't just take the loss or get all down. But the drubbing had vexed and deflated her. The campaign, which she'd resisted jumping into, was proving to be joyless. Ruiz hoped to change that with a plan of action that would play to Hillary's favorite way of campaigning. But first, she had to deliver the bad news. "What we're doing is not working," the usually high-strung Texan explained in an even tone. Bernie was closing, and fast. "We're changing course," Ruiz told Hillary. She proposed a gamble in a much higher-stakes contest than the games of blackjack and roulette playing out on Mandalay Bay tables below them. Bernie was going big, huge rallies, and a 30,000-foot message about unrigging the American economy. Hillary, she said, should go small in the final week. She had to go to Nevadans, where they lived, ate, and worked, and she had to do it around the clock. She should prove she could outwork anyone, a value highly regarded by the very union and working-class people of color she needed to spend hours with at caucus sites, Ruiz said. And she would loosen up a bit. Get off script by interacting openly with voters in sessions that weren't open to reporters. Part of the plan was specific to Nevada and its fast-approaching caucus, but part of it was a gambit to pull Hillary out of her funk. She could move out of the campaign bubble, feed off the energy of the people she hoped to represent in the White House, and drink in a little love at a time when she was feeling down. That part was unspoken, but central to Ruiz's thinking. While contemplative in her decision-making process and prone to taking only calculated risks, Hillary harbors a deep bias for acting over standing pat. It was that trait that drove her to support the raid that killed Osama bin Laden in 2011, at a time when Obama's advisors were badly divided over the risks of a covert strike. And so, high above Las Vegas that Saturday, in a hotel connected to a renowned casino, the cautious candidate came to understand that she would have to gamble on an unorthodox new strategy if she hoped to hold off Sanders and turn her campaign around. At the risk that ceding the public stage to Sanders would fuel his surge, Hillary committed to working the kitchens, high school band rooms, and soccer fields of Las Vegas. She nodded her approval. The next day, Hillary met with a group of Dreamers at one of her campaign offices in Las Vegas. Her campaign moved the press out after her opening remarks, and Hillary asked if anyone wanted to ask her a question. At first, the room was silent. Then a few of the children posed questions. One young girl, fighting back tears, told Hillary she was afraid her parents, who had entered the country illegally, would be deported. "Come here," Hillary said. The girl got up and walked across the room to where Hillary sat, as the adults in the room applauded her. Hillary, still seated, wrapped her arm around the girl. "I'm going to do everything I can so you don't have to be scared, And you don't have to worry about what happens to your mom or your dad or somebody else in your family, Hillary said. I feel really, really strongly. But you're being brave, and you have to be brave for them, too, because they want you to be happy. They want you to be successful. They don't want you to worry too much. Let me do the worrying. I'll do all the worrying. Is that a deal? I'll do the worry. I'll do everything I can to help, okay? Then the girl hugged Hillary. Ruiz and her team watched video of the moment over and over again, some of them crying. Back in Brooklyn, Oren Schur's video team stayed up into the wee hours of the night cutting the raw footage into a television spot. They called it Brave. The ad struck a nerve in Hillary Land because it showed compassion, her concern for children, families, and minorities. A young girl reaching out to hug her and a genuineness that Hillary had trouble evincing in larger settings. In just 60 seconds, the ad tore away layers of Hillary, accessing what her aides and allies called the real Hillary. She had gone small to a private meeting with dreamers and come away with a means of translating her intimacy to the masses. Until that moment, her ads hadn't been as strong as Sanders's. A little less than 2 weeks before the Iowa caucuses, Bernie had released a spot called America that mixed images of Americans at work and play with those of him shaking hands with voters and those of his big campaign rallies. Playing to the backdrop of the Simon and Garfunkel song of the same name, it contained no words. But it was widely praised for placing the candidate within an American community. Now Hillary could show, in a fashion that wasn't pre-packaged, that she was running to be a champion for someone else. She would do the worrying and the fighting for the underdogs in society, like the 10-year-old Latina so frightened about the possibility of her parents being sent away. It was the message Hillary wanted to convey in her campaign, but the near miss in Iowa and crushing loss in New Hampshire had given her plenty of reason to doubt that she could persuade voters of its authenticity. The moment with the little girl finally tapped directly into her motive for running, allies said. At her lowest point on the campaign trail, faced with Sanders's rising popularity, anxiety among her allies, and her own self-doubt, Hillary moved into safe spaces. She was going home in ways abstract and concrete. Moore created that on her plane, giving her a friend, not an aide, a consultant, a donor, or a well-wisher, to open up with. Going small in Nevada meant she would have a comfort zone at campaign events. And on the Tuesday before the state's caucuses, Hillary literally went home to New York, to Harlem, to reset her message in a way that she hoped would appeal both to minority voters she needed to win in Nevada, South Carolina, and the Super Tuesday primaries on March 1st, and, hopefully, to the white voters with whom she continued to struggle. Her theme, rolled out in part in her New Hampshire concession speech and built upon in the Milwaukee debate, revolved around the breaking barriers concept that Schwerin and Sullivan had spun. Long before Hillary began campaigning for president, many of her closest friends had come to the conclusion that she had to find a way to connect her personal narrative to the hardships of working and middle-class Americans and position herself as a worthy champion for their causes. Intellectually, Hillary could grasp the benefits of the construct. It cast her, the former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State, as a hero. It was genuinely true that she had blazed trails in politics and policy, and it tipped the balance of emphasis a little further away from her and toward the people she hoped would elect her president. But for nearly a year on the campaign trail, she hadn't been able to connect all the dots. She spoke about I and you, but almost never we. When supporters declared their allegiance to her online, They did it with hashtag I'm with her. For whatever reason, she chalked it up to Midwestern modesty. She felt uncomfortable presenting herself as the heroine. And yet critics saw her reluctance to use we, like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and so many other candidates did, as evidence that her campaign was all about her. It was one of the subtle but unmistakable ways in which every action of Hillary's, every uttered pronoun even, became a political Rorschach test. There was nothing particularly catchy about breaking barriers as a slogan or a mission statement, but it served its purposes well enough, making her personal story part of the narrative of the campaign. Not only did she promise to break down barriers for voters, but she had the credibility of being a barrier breaker herself, appealing to minority voters who worried about both economic and social constraints on their opportunities and outcomes, and reaching out to white voters who cared about social justice. Hillary had begun teasing the breaking barriers mantra in New Hampshire and Wisconsin, but she really hammered it home in Harlem. Hold me accountable. Hold every candidate accountable, Hillary told a mostly black audience in a speech defined by its concentration on racial justice. You deserve leaders who will do whatever it takes to tear down all the barriers holding you back and then replace them with those ladders of opportunity that every American deserves. In spirit, this was the campaign she wanted to run, even though she didn't love the catchphrase. In her mind, her whole life had been about public service, from helping poor families through the Children's Defense Fund to high-level government jobs. It was ridiculous, she thought, that anyone could portray her as purely motivated by self-interest. What the hell had Bernie Sanders ever accomplished to improve the quality of anyone else's life? He could talk until he was blue in the face about economic justice, but she'd fought for decades to even playing fields at the micro and macro levels. What did Bernie think Hillary Care was about? And the children's health insurance program? And how could anyone pretend that racial injustice wasn't a key barrier to the economic advancement of people of color? She had fought for the most forgotten people in American society, the poor women and children, often black and Hispanic, throughout her adult life. More than that, she had scars from those brawls, from being demonized for elevating the invisible people in American society, even at the expense of the haves. She cared about opportunity and outcome, about incentives and assistance. The Harlem speech just felt right to her. For the first time in weeks, maybe months, she was at home on the campaign trail. I am so comfortable speaking about this stuff, she told Moore on the plane back to Washington for a fundraiser in Northern Virginia. I feel like these are things I need to be talking about. But Hillary still didn't love the breaking barriers slogan. It was a temporary salve. She still wasn't articulating a vision that could turn her from a candidate inexorably linked with the past into an avatar of the future. Tactically, she was doing what needed to be done to win delegates, the all-important, if unsexy, measure of success in presidential nominating contests. She was all science, no art. This time, though, she had built herself a victory lab. The best delegate strategists, and a top analytics team. She also had the hard-earned experience to believe only one goal mattered, the 2,383 delegates needed to secure the nomination. The route to that number ran through the heavily black Democratic primary electorates of the Deep South states and the heavily Hispanic congressional districts west of the Mississippi. Hillary staked her strategy on the premise that she could run up the score with minority voters and build an insurmountable delegate lead on the strength of their support. Now, having survived Iowa and New Hampshire, it was time to execute. But the execution had to come against the backdrop of tension inside the campaign headquarters and anxiety among the Clinton faithful around the country. The blowout in New Hampshire had rattled the Democratic firmament, and now the pressure was coming from everywhere. It was a very hard 10 days between the New Hampshire primary and the Nevada caucuses, said one campaign aide. It was brutal. As they tried to right the ship, Clinton and her top aides fielded a stream of calls, emails, and text messages demanding to know what the hell had happened and what they were going to do to fix the campaign. It was a frustrating and lonely moment for Hillary. Her husband had started to bear down on Mook. He wanted to know everything about the playbook for Nevada. "We have a strategy," Mook told Bill, according to one ally. "Nothing has changed in Nevada. We are sticking to it." The margin might narrow, he reassured both Clintons, but Hillary was positioned to win. Hillary chose to stick to her guns. She had faith in Robbie, the ally said. Hillary may have felt assured, but she couldn't convince her supporters to look past sensational headlines, an ugly defeat in New Hampshire, or a waiting-for-the-other-shoe-to-drop fear of her email scandal. She was starting to feel better, but they were not. "We had a full-on office plan to really go after our people and say, 'This is why this happened this way. Stay with the plan,'" one top Clinton lieutenant recalled. It didn't really work. Donors, members of Congress, and assorted Democratic chatterers couldn't, or wouldn't, relax. Representative Marcia Fudge, the dominant political presence in Cleveland, lobbied Marshall hard for answers. She and other members of the Congressional Black Caucus wanted to make sure Hillary was focused on South Carolina. Marshall was a point of contact, in part because the CBC didn't trust Mook from his time as the cutthroat top executive at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, when his boss, Steve Israel, had gone to war with black lawmakers over members' dues to the party and the party's policy of neutrality in primaries. Similarly, Hispanic lawmakers told Clinton and her aides they should be focused on Nevada and its Latino population. Women senators burned up phone lines, too, and they had more direct means of getting in her ear. Several of them had traveled to New Hampshire for Hillary, only to see her get crushed. Former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, annoyed by the campaign's failure to utilize him, sent Podesta a snarky note about an unreturned email from January. "Maybe you guys don't need any extra help, given recent results," Richardson wrote in the days after the New Hampshire primary. "You don't need to respond if you're too busy. Just have someone send me the talking points." Calls came in from the Castro brothers, Texas Representative Joaquin, and Housing and Urban Development Secretary and Vice Presidential hopeful Julian. Former Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, who served with Clinton in the Senate, wondered how he could help ahead of Nevada when things seemed the most grim. Former HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros and Representatives Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico and Javier Becerra of California were concerned about the Hispanic vote and picking up where the campaign left off in 2008. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, a longtime Clinton supporter who sat behind her during much of her Benghazi testimony, and other members of the CBC dialed up top campaign aides to tell them black voters wouldn't turn out like they did for Obama without a full push by the campaign. Lee was a gadfly in Congress whom most people just wrote off as crazy. But some of the other callers were taken more seriously. Hillary would have to fight hard to secure votes, they said. "Listen, this isn't going to be easy," Fudge reminded Marshall. Senators Debbie Stabenow of Michigan and Barbara Boxer of California, whose daughter was once married to Tony Rodham, Hillary's brother, checked in with Clinton's political director, Amanda Renteria, on a regular basis, though largely to relay the concerns of others and advise when Hillary needed to do a little hand-holding on Capitol Hill. The questions came fast and furious. Why did Hillary's campaign spend time and money in New Hampshire if they were going to get beaten that badly? And if they could have made it closer, why didn't they spend more and earlier? Was there a fundamental flaw in the campaign's strategy? Give it time, Renteria counseled over and over. Trust us. But the younger operators of the Clinton machine, including Mook, Renteria, and Marshall, hadn't yet earned the trust of the party establishment. If anything, Democratic leaders, particularly older members, were worried that Hillary had built another iceberg-seeking campaign ship. The younger generation of Democratic officials, one Hillary advisor explained, mostly wanted to help. But the older Democrats, the alumni of Congress and the Clinton administration, pressured campaign officials about their strategy, tactics, and competence. Campaign contributors, those with a monetary stake in the game, fretted even more than the party leaders. They're the ones that get more persnickety, a senior campaign official said. These bedwetters consumed more and more of the campaign's time, just as Hillary needed to turn the corner and sprint through late February and early March. It wasn't just that they didn't trust her team. They didn't trust Hillary. For the first time in her career, she held the hopes of the Democratic Party in her hands, and that made the party poobahs nervous. After all, she'd done the crazy thing with her emails, given speeches for money at a time when it could clearly come back to bite her, and run a disaster of a campaign operation in 2008. Was New Hampshire a bump in the road, or a rock slide that would knock her and the Democratic Party off the cliff? And with Donald Trump starting to emerge as the favorite in the Republican primary field, might they go into battle against him with a self-styled socialist? They scrambled to make sure both of her hands were on the wheel at 10 and 2. If beaten down a bit, Hillary remained confident that the turn toward Nevada, South Carolina, and a Super Tuesday slate of states dominated by voters of color would bring victories and a sense of stability. But the Sanders surge, his near win in Iowa and stomping of Clinton in New Hampshire, left doubts in the backs of the minds of her Brooklyn Brain Trust. Now the margins mattered a lot. Could Sanders use that momentum and his economic message to break through with black and Hispanic voters? If so, how much? With Senator Sanders, he, quite frankly, is a senator from Vermont, said one Hillary aide discussing his challenge in South Carolina. There's no history there with the African-American community, versus someone who's been known to have fought for the African-American community for 25 years. So I knew we were going to win. I did not know the margin, and I knew we had to earn it, too. Meanwhile, Bernie was pouring resources into Nevada. There was an opportunity for him to win a second straight contest, pick up momentum, and then test the Clinton theory that South Carolina and the black vote were a true firewall. The Silver State was kind of a forgotten state in the Democratic primary process. Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina topped the national news pages and broadcasts. But suddenly, Nevada became another opportunity for Sanders to gain ground and for Clinton to fall behind. She could hear his footsteps. Elon Kriegel, Hillary's 34-year-old analytics guru, shared updates on the state of the race with her and a small set of top campaign aides and advisors every 2 or 3 days. He was regarded as something of an oracle in the Brooklyn headquarters, deriving his power from a combination of the mystique surrounding his unique numbers and the belief that both Mook and Hillary had in the power of data. While he would share the results his algorithm spit out, he kept his methods close to his vest. On Valentine's Day, his horse race analytics surveys had Hillary up 7 points. 3 days later, and 3 days before the caucus, it was down to 5 points. Kriegel sounded optimistic, but cautioned that in enthusiasm and education gap, Bernie voters were more likely to know how the caucuses worked, could alter the landscape. The campaign would devote attention to teaching participants about the process, he reported. By the day before the caucus, the analytics team surveys showed a 4-point Hillary margin, 48% to 44%. Kriegel added a worrisome footnote to his report that day. We are concerned about some data that suggests people of color are less excited to caucus than white voters, he wrote to colleagues in a message that foreshadowed trouble for Hillary down the line. If this manifests itself, it could impact the margin negatively. The trend was going in the wrong direction. Like Iowa, Nevada would test whether Mook's no more than necessary field operation, an exacting deployment of resources based on analytics projections, could withstand the energy of Bernie's masses. One longtime ally who was on the ground in Nevada called into Brooklyn the night before the caucuses. What's going to happen? The ally asked a top member of Hillary's brain trust. We're going to lose, the campaign aide replied, explaining that Hillary's internal polls showed a slight but too small lead for her. Sanders had overperformed in public and internal polling in both Iowa and New Hampshire. He had the momentum. He wins, the aide predicted. That foreboding feeling permeated Brooklyn. Two of Hillary's top communications aides, Brian Fallon and Christina Reynolds, prepared a set of talking points that would paper over a loss in Nevada, pressing the media to focus on the upcoming contests in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday. The tone of the talking points was described as defensive by a person who saw them. But on the ground in the Silver State, Hillary's aides were getting a different feeling. On Friday night, as Hillary spoke at a big rally in